Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a channel in the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil, PhD student at the University of Delaware. And today we have the opportunity to chat with Dr. Matthew Harper, Assistant Professor of History and Africana Studies at Mercer University in Georgia. And we'll be talking to him about his book, published by our friends at UNC Press in 2016, entitled End of Days, African American Religion and Politics in the Age of Emancipation. Hello there, Dr. Harper. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. And we're, you know, it's been a long time coming, as the song goes, but it's definitely coming, this interview, at the correct time. And I'm definitely happy to have you on the program today to talk about your tremendous book.
Yeah, well, thanks, Adam.
Very good. And so before we start talking about your book, can you please talk to us about, we're talking about, African-American religion. So I think it's appropriate to say, what was the genesis story like for you with this particular book?
You know, I was taking a graduate course, and one of my professors, Grant Wacker, said, there's a collection of almost a full run of a Black religious newspaper that just is just really rich, and it's on microfilm, and people ought to read it, and you ought to just spend this semester reading it. And it was the Star of Zion, which was the organ of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in North Carolina. And he said, just start reading it. And I just started reading it, and I felt this really deep connection. I just fell into this world reading issue after issue. And I initially thought, reading it, that I really wanted to talk about the connections that Black ministers in the post-emancipation South made between institutions. They were in the Masons. They were building churches. They were building political organizations. They were involved in Black militias. And I really imagined trying to help people see the connections, really, of institutions all across the South that Black ministers were involved in and working. They're the ones who were largely writing this newspaper, writing into it and editing it. And I found their world fascinating and wanted to write about it. And as I kept reading these newspapers and the Source Project expanded, I kept noticing an intellectual question, because I really think the network question was a social history question. You know, how are all these networks built and connected? How are all these institutions working together? And but instead, I kept noticing references to eschatology, to the end of days, to end times, to biblical prophecy. And I would sort of make a little note and put it into a different stack and say, maybe this will be an article or something. I keep noticing it. And then ultimately, my stack on that overwhelmed my original research. And I the project just changed directions at that point.
And that's a really cool introductory story, because I always find it fascinating how scholars of various disciplines come into their particular topics, because a lot of times, right, you have that, you have that spark, you have that professor in a seminar, in a lecture say, go check something out. And then ultimately, 25 to 30 years later, you look back and say, oh, my gosh. That is, in fact, where the story began for me. And so I always love starting out interviews like that, because I think it's always fascinating, like I said, and it's also very informative for the audience to know a bit about the scholars and where they came from with their work. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. It's, for me, it was really valuable just to immerse myself for a while in source material without really knowing where I was going to go. I hope that other scholars feel that freedom to do that. I think some of the best work comes when people know sources really well, even if they don't have a book proposal in mind. It's just, it was wonderful for me to become fluent in the world of 19th century Black churches. And then figure out what I had to say after I understood their world and felt like I was a part of it.
Exactly. And so because what happens, I think this goes to issues within the academy about training of graduate students and even of scholars, as they get their first jobs, right? You know, like you said, right, having the opportunity and you know, pushing, you know, especially graduate students to, like you said, immerse yourself in source material, because, you know, you don't always know where things are going to take you, but you just want to be, you just want to have the freedom to take that the archive on a ride, or the archive, I guess, take you for a ride, depending on the way it goes, so that you have the opportunity to have the depth of knowledge to where if you see like a CFP come up, a call for paper, you could be like, well, I'm fairly immersed in this archive, so I think I can really make something work, right? In a way that if you kind of have cursory understanding of an archive, you won't necessarily have that same understanding of the material. And where did you do your graduate studies, so that the audience knows?
Yes, I did it at UNC Chapel Hill.
Okay. And as we know, you know, UNC Chapel Hill has been in the news the last 24 hours as we're making this interview.
That's right. Making and remaking history. That's right.
Exactly. Back in the state where this work comes from. And so getting into the end of days, African-American religion and politics in the age of emancipation. Can you talk to us a bit about, and I think you highlighted a bit more, but can you give us a bit more of a depth of understanding of for this particular story, why the state of North Carolina would play a prominent role in your story?
Right. Well, North Carolina offers several advantages. It's a rural southern state that with a substantial population of freed people, but it's also got several urban centers that were well connected with northeastern hubs of Black institutional religion, so New York and Philadelphia, and Baltimore, and so. It's got a number of Black religious colleges and seminaries that were founded in the post-emancipation period. Some of the earliest Black Southern religious newspapers are published in North Carolina. For the study that I wanted to do, I didn't want it to be an intellectual Black history that happened only at the rhetorical level nationally. I wanted to see how these ideas that people had affected local and state politics. So much of 19th century politics is local and state that I really needed to pick a particular locale and dig deep and figure out how these ideas mattered to Black political decision-making on the ground. I can imagine a study would have worked well in other places. I think of John Gigi's really masterful cultural history about the Mississippi Delta, which seems like a very different place than North Carolina at the same time period. So place matters and it varies. But what I get in North Carolina is I get urban, intellectual, seminary-educated Black religious thought, and I also get rural, less educated religious thought that is unconnected to the cultural centers of Philadelphia or New York. So you get a lot of cross-section, a lot of different things happening in North Carolina, and they also had the institutions in place. Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian seminaries, all African-American, founded in the 19th century, that recorded these conversations. So it's not that the conversations that Black people of faith were having in North Carolina were somehow substantially different or more representative than other areas. But when they had those conversations, there were institutions in place to keep a record.
And that's why, because when we talk about keeping records, the church that did that among the best in this particular age of emancipation that you speak of was it the AME Zion Church, correct?
That's right. The AME Zion is the smaller sister of the AME Church. The AME Church is much more successful at sending missionaries among freed people and establishing churches throughout the South during the Age of Emancipation. But in a couple of locales, the AME Zion really had a clear advantage. And North Carolina was one of those where the AME Zion was more successful at founding churches among former enslaved people than the AME was. And Methodist in general keep records, and they have a connectional structure which allows their records to be housed together, which facilitates conversation across congregations in different areas within a region and a state that the more decentralized Baptists don't have. And so Amy Zion really left a treasure trove of material from the time period.
And so that's why, you know, the and we talked about this a bit offline, you know, how I have a particular connection to the big brother slash sister and the little sister of being the AME and the AME Zion through my family connection in this region. And so, you know, that was to let the listeners in on a bit of my background. And that's why, you know, when I saw this book come across my radar, I was like, man, I got to get Dr. Harper on here because, you know, this book is not only important in the field, but it's also important personally, too. So I always, you know, find ways of integrating both of those so that I can, you know, have my clergy family members be like, hey, I got something for y'all. I got a present.
Yeah.
And your book is definitely a delightful present for us all.
Well, thank you. One of the things I hope that the book does is it pulls the conversation out of just the churches. I mean, I think one of the things I found most striking is that these religious conversations about the ways that particular theologies affect particular Black political decisions, that those aren't happening just in the church. They're happening in Masonic meetings, they're happening in women's club meetings, they're happening in the state legislature, they're happening in sharecropper meetings. And that this theological conversation is not something that's kept within the walls of church. The churches are really prominent in the book, but in many ways, it's not a church history book. It's really a political history book where the church and other institutions are all having very similar kinds of conversations that overlap theology and politics.
And I think that integration with theology and politics, especially in this age coming in the emancipation age, right? I think that was the part that overlap, I thought, was why your book was so important, because, right, for many, the Civil War encapsulated many areas of the Bible, right? So you know, looking at, you know, how people interpret events, right, was that hermeneutics, and so looking at how people interpret the Bible in conjunction with the events that are happening in their world, I think it was so. If I got hermeneutics right, I might have gotten that wrong, but looking at how, you know, folks look at the events that are occurring in their lifetime in accordance with their religious texts. So I thought that was such a profound way and an important way for folks to better understand that. So that was definitely a highlight for myself.
That's what I noticed. I mean, I think we've noticed for a long time that Americans, white and Black and other, and of various religious perspectives, saw the Civil War as a meaning of such an event of such great magnitude, that there was this search for meaning. What could it possibly mean that so many Americans died? What could it possibly mean that 4 million people were freed in one event? What could this possibly mean for the nation? And that search for meaning for many Americans was providential, right? Where's God's hand in this? How can we interpret this, the meaning of this, as God at work in human history? And I think for those who had experienced emancipation themselves, their own emancipation, it took on even more poignant meaning for them to understand, you know, if I'm to interpret that God has intervened in human history to affect my liberation and the liberation of all my family members, then he must be up to something big, right? There must be some larger plan, which this is the climax of. And then the task, the theological task and the political task, becomes discerning what is it? What is that great plan that God had in emancipation? And how can we understand the past and predict the future by figuring out what God is up to in emancipation?
Exactly, because when I think about how emancipation is interpreted, right, and that's why it's also important, listeners, when you look at the book as well, right, the in the age of emancipation, right, because all this is happening connected to a particular a seismic event, shall we say, that really hit that high note on the Richter scale that changed, you know, the entire nation. And obviously we're talking about the Civil War here. And so how folks, you know, interpret it is very important, especially in accordance to their denominational aspect as well, it seemed like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not that we haven't gotten away from that the power of the meaning of that event. That's why we're embroiled in these conversations about the Confederate monuments, is because it's the way in which we remember that conflict, the meaning that we give it, is still powerful for people, right? That there is political power in how we remember and interpret the events of the past. And that was definitely true for the people who lived in the immediate aftermath of emancipation.
And because of that too, with us having talked a bit about this already, but getting more in depth, could you speak to us about the major players in your text as well? Could you talk about a bit about the individuals who make up your story here?
Yeah, there's some of them are homegrown North Carolinians who had been enslaved. And then immediately after emancipation, got involved in politics. Here, I think of in my first chapter, I talk about the earliest efforts for African Americans to organize politically in a series of freedmen's conventions that take place across the state and then in the Capitol. And some of those were those who had been active, who for the first time in politics in the state recently emancipated. Others had been African Americans born in the state who had been educated somewhere else and then returned during the war, people like Abraham Galloway, for example, and others, many others, were Black Northern missionaries who came right behind the Union Army lines, planting churches as the Army advanced throughout North Carolina. Probably the most prominent of that is James Walker Hood, who was an AME Zion minister, ultimately becomes bishop, becomes Grand Master of the Prince Hall Masons for the state. Is a Reconstruction office holder and stays active in politics there till the end of his life in the early 20th century. So we've got lots of different kinds of institutional leaders who are having these conversations.
And I thought that because I've really thought a lot because I came across a scholar by the name of Dr. Abigail Cooper, who wrote about the some of the contraband camps and missionaries and Black women. And so I started to percolate, right, some thoughts about, you know, how this age was also, as you talk about, the missionary aspect, right? Mm-hmm. Northern Black folks coming down, right, with a particular understanding of Blackness, and like folks like Charlotte Fortin and her story on the Sea Islands, right? And she wrote prominently about, right, these differences between, right, the Blackness that she saw. She might not have explicitly talked about, but you could tell in how she characterized those of Black religious folks, right, on the Sea Islands or in the Sea Islands during the Civil War. And so when certain areas of this book made me think about the same thing and how, you know, the nature of missionary work is still something that I'm really glad there's coming more and more scholarship on it, because I think it's one of the areas that is very much needed in our understanding of kind of Christian charity. And also my mother works for the Salvation Army too. So there are particular personal potential stakes that I have in that as well, with that affiliation too.
Yeah, I tell you, you know, Milton Sernett does a really good job of painting that picture for us during the Great Migration of what happened in Northern cities when you had Northern churches who had one style of worship, one style of theology, a different kind of tradition, and then these rural Southern churchgoers flooding into their churches, and the conflict between these two traditions, or the mixing of these two traditions at one moment. But it happens a generation earlier when those Northern Black missionaries come into areas that already have established forms of worship, both public and secret worship. And they have to then, these traditions have to merge again. We see some of that in the earliest Freedmen's Conventions. There's fights over, you know, whether or not the delegates to those conventions can accurately represent the people that they're supposed to represent. Are they outsiders? How do local people control their own voice and sometimes feel suspicious about electing or delegates who come from out of state and may not think the same way that local people do? Those conflicts show up in the earliest minutes.
And I love that you mentioned the conventions, right? Because, you know, I also work at the University of Delaware with the Colored Conventions Project, and so, you know, this movement, right, that you mentioned is very, very important in trying to understand, you know, how Black folks and how Black religious and political leaders, how they interpreted, right, what is going forward, because now that the world is different and there's change and that emancipation is here during the day, you know, what world are they going to build, right? What world are they going to create? And so in those conventions, you see a lot of that kind of, you know, vein of thinking going into the what we now see in the convention minutes and how they planned for an unknown future. And I think that part right there, the unknown future, right? Because it's so easy for us in 2018 to be able to look back and be like, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, how the hell are they going to know in 1865, in 1866, or 68, or 70, or these particular time frames? They had no earthly doggone idea what was about to happen. And I think that part can be kind of scary, but, you know, it's a nice historical exercise.
Yeah, but what's surprising to me is actually how many people seem to possess a sense of foresight, a confidence about a future that they couldn't see or that they hadn't experienced. You know, I opened the book with a story of Edwin Jones, who was a stump political speaker, African-American, in 1867, who confidently preaches from Joshua chapter 4 that he knows that Black people are going to get the right to vote. And this is before, you know, reasonably you'd be able to say that that's the case. And so it's like, so that was one of these puzzling questions for me, is that how in a world that was so uncertain, where it was not, the emancipation had not answered fundamental questions about Black political rights, how much confidence people had by reading scriptures in a particular way that allowed them to discern God's purpose in human history, predict the future, and make political decisions in light of that, that there's a vision that people had. Not that it's the same vision. I mean, one of the things I really tried to stress in the book is the amount of debating that's going on, right? That Black ministers don't agree, Black politicians don't agree, people in the pew don't agree with the ministers, people from the North don't agree with the South, people in different denominations disagree, that there's not a single way that Black people understood God's purposes in emancipation. But what there was a similar framework that set the terms of debate, that God was active in emancipation, and that the scriptures held keys to understanding the future, and that there was this importance to what was going on. And by placing Black experience into biblical narratives, that they could discern this future that in the moment must have seemed very uncertain, very fraught, freedoms that seemed very fragile. But there was a common way of reading scriptures and a common framework that set the terms for debates. And in those debates, Black people did not agree.
Exactly. And so I also think, too, about more of a methodological question, too. As a scholar, right, because I don't really dabble in my particular work within the realm of Black religion, but I have a large interest in it. As someone who's in this particular field of Black politics and Black religion, and kind of like at that intersection, when you're analyzing the particular sources, right? Is there a particular methodological way that you'll go about this, or you know, are there particular questions that, because you're dealing with folks, right, and dealing with faith, I guess, right, faith in something that you don't know? Is there a particular way that you go about your sources that are maybe a bit different? So you know, it's largely an ignorant question maybe, but largely I literally don't know. So literally it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a good question. I try to read my sources carefully and closely. The world of the Bible provided people an entire universe of symbols, images, stories that allowed people a language world, is what one scholar calls it, a way to piece together meaning and talk about the world, the sort of Bible itself as an idiom. And we see this all over Black author documents in the 19th century. You'll even see it in a lot of non-religious writers will have quotations from scriptural stories or biblical imagery in the titles of their books. But often those images go uninvestigated. Like, right? What does somebody mean when they say city on a hill? What biblical reference is that? When someone says the word Jubilee, that's a reference to Leviticus. What does it mean? I decided to just follow up every reference, every symbol, every image, whether it came from a spiritual or it came from an Old Testament story, or whether it came from some bit of the Gospels or something that Jesus was recorded saying in one of the Gospels, or a passage from the Psalms, a prophecy from Jeremiah. It was to assume that the writers did not haphazardly sprinkle biblical references throughout their book, throughout their writings, whether that was a letter to the editor or a sermon or a political speech, but that they did so deliberately, and that those allusions to scripture carry particular meaning. And one of the ways I was able to find that out is to read other sources in response. That is, was the readership of these writers attuned to the particular biblical references that were being made? And the answer was yes. And I'll give you one example is an early a political document that gets referenced often in Reconstruction studies in 1870. When Black state legislatures under attack, the Republican governor is being impeached by a hostile legislature, and the Klan is running rampant through the middle counties of North Carolina. And they produce a document that interprets their entire struggle as the retelling of Queen Esther's story, which is one of the exile narratives in the Hebrew Bible. And they retell it, and everyone gets a part. And ostensibly, that document is a call to prayer and fasting. But if you know the story of Queen Esther, you know that that at the end of that story, the politically persecuted minority group, that is the Jews who were living in Persia, they don't actually win politically. The king doesn't call off the enemies. Instead, the king says, well, we've already put out an edict that calls for the massacre of Jews. And in Persia, you can't override a royal edict. It can never be repealed, not even by the king. But he gives them another edict that allows them self-defense. And so nowhere in that document that refers to Esther do the authors ever talk about a right to armed self-defense. But it's very clear that everyone who read that article, read that circular, was alarmed, talked about it in those terms, understood that by referencing Esther, they were making a claim for armed self-defense. And so I think it's really important for us not to look at religious documents or look at religious language and say, oh, look, here's a reference to Moses, or here's a reference to bondage, and here's a reference to a nation's being born in a day, or here's a reference to the 23rd Psalm, and say, this must be religious. Instead, we got to figure out, well, what is the reference? What's the prophecy that's being referred to? What's the story? Because there's a lot of meaning in these in these stories. And people are often referencing different stories to stake out different arguments within Black communities or to make claims from Black communities to the white elite. And so we miss a lot of what's going on in Black politics if we don't read religious sources carefully and closely.
And I think that's so true in the sense that, obviously, the world and life is much different now in 2018 and in comparison to, this time frame when it comes to nascent and cursory understanding of religious texts and such. But I think you highlighted a very, very important intersection when it comes to religion and politics, which I don't think people have ever really stopped understanding. It's just how it manifests itself, right? So because of the religious right is literally in its name, religious and right, right? So it's very much, really the religion and the politics, but it's very much in a different context with a different kind of set of rules. And so it's taking it back to the 1860s and 1870s and 1880s within the sphere of Blackness, it's a different kind of life. And so, like you said, to not take into account the AME review, right? Benjamin Tanner, right? The important religious text, right? You look at someone like even to take it out of North Carolina, you look at William J. Simmons, right, who gave a lot of opportunities to a lot of Black women within the Black Baptist movement. Dr. Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham talks about so prominently with Righteous Discontent, which is a book everybody needs to read, y'all. It's older than me. And so I really think that you highlighted something that's very important because politically you can't not talk about it, I think, too, especially because I interviewed Reverend Dr. Gary Dorian for the first part of his two-part series on the Black social gospel. And you don't have King unless you have right. You also don't have Bishop McNeil as well. You don't have him and other figures unless you have, these particular conventions, the Black social gospel. But it's all intermingling in the kind of work that you're doing. So all of this is really also in conversation with your work, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we sometimes don't ask the right question about the intersection of religion and politics. We want to know how much religion and politics, or where is religion involved in politics. We sometimes ask, did religion drive people to politics or drive them away from politics, give them an otherworldly focus on the next life? And even when we're talking about contemporary issues, we talk about the religious right as, do we want religion in our politics? All of this assumes that religion is a singular thing and you can add it or take it away from politics. It sort of motivates or inspires people to get involved, or that it shapes politics in a particular direction. But, the religious ideas are so diverse. Even the texts in scripture are myriad texts and people interpret them in myriad ways. And so, we need to spend more time just asking the how question, like which religious ideas affect which political ideas in what ways, right? Otherwise, we end up lumping together the religious right and Moral Mondays, which is a religious political movement in North Carolina today. And we end up lumping all of these together and not understanding the ways in which different religious ideas impact politics in different ways. We can't sort of measure this on one axis, how much religion in our politics. That's really not the right way to answer. That'd be like, how much economics in our politics doesn't make sense as a question, right? Which economic systems, which ideas, who affected them, right? And so this is something I think that religious historians have understood, but sometimes doesn't always make its way into our better political histories, which is to know that we can't just talk about, was religion important to Black politics? Yes, it was important. The question we have to ask is, which Black religious ideas right? And which, how do different ideas affect Black politics differently? We've got to dig deeper and get to the content of religion if we're going to understand how religion and politics work together.
And that's why we like to highlight, you know, you talked about, you know, religious historians being, you know, ones that, you know, who make these particular ideas and know about these particular quandaries that befall our society when it comes to our understanding at the intersection of race and politics. So that's why I'm glad that I was able to get you on the program to be able to highlight your work, because you're definitely someone whose scholarship, especially, you know, in the case of what we talked about online too, about your next project, which we can get to on here a little later. But you know, your work is definitely hinting on a lot of these particular important 19th century, but also 21st century issues about, you know, because largely as well, right, there's some citizenship stakes that are involved in a lot of these debates too, right? Because not only do you have a new nation, but you have a new meaning on and a new lease on who is American, who gets to be American. And so all these are citizenship and democratic ideals, but they're being acted out in a time frame of a lot of turmoil, but a lot of opportunity as well.
Right. And recently freed people encounter that problem in different ways. Like they too are trying to imagine what place will they have in this nation as citizens. And for many of them, they look to biblical narratives to help make sense of their place in the nation. So there are those who looked to an Exodus narrative, and in that narrative saw, right, that following freedom is a mass migration to a new homeland, right? And that if African Americans are not experiencing full citizenship after emancipation, it must be that they're supposed to reenact the migration of ancient Hebrews out of Egypt through the wilderness and into a new land. And so we see, particularly in the collapse of Reconstruction, migration movements to Kansas, other places in the West, to Liberia. We see in North Carolina, oddly, a migration to Indiana as a promised land. And then other African Americans say, no, we don't need to see an Exodus is a mass migration. Instead, we ought to look to other biblical narratives like Jubilee in the book of Leviticus, which is the claim that that slaves are freed on the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, and that there's property redistribution so that the land goes back to original owners, and those who had lost land or become enslaved in the previous 50 years get to start over with a clean slate. And so we see really powerful arguments by Black Southerners for a right to the land. And that narrative of understanding we belong here and we have a full and equal right to the land itself is really different than those who are claiming migration as the way to fulfill God's promises and emancipation. And the Esther narrative that I just mentioned uses the exile narratives of the Old Testament to really think, what is the place of a persecuted minority within a land where the majority is hostile to their very presence? And how do you eke out an existence in that kind of scenario? So whether it's Exodus or exile or Jubilee, the way that African Americans use the Bible to understand their place in the nation after freedom varies wildly.
And I really enjoyed that particular part because that particular part of your story, because for one, you know, scholars like Nell Irvin Painter and her Exodusters, a prominent book from some time ago, and you know, I'd recently interviewed Annalisa Cox for her book, The Bone and Sinew of the Land, talking about Black pioneers. And so, you know, a little bit beforehand, but you saw some African Americans coming from North Carolina, so there had been a migratory bit as well prior. But the interesting part that you highlight is how, right, so you have these different emigration stories, but it's also like, how do people justify them just staying here, right? And that's where you go to back towards the religious nature of your subjects here, and how many of them saw North Carolina as the place where hell or high water, they're still going to stay, despite some appalling and very violent repression of them. Would you be able to highlight some of the repression that they faced while in North Carolina for those who did decide to stay?
I mean, the violence was physical. We have the book highlights a lot of the terrorism by the Klan in the 1870s, and there's a migration out of the state shortly after that. We've got ministers, school teachers being shot, pregnant women being killed, children being tortured. It's really horrific. And they're giving testimony on this. We've got elected representatives being murdered in the basements of county courthouses during political conventions. So it's a bloody and dangerous time for people. But a lot of the persecution is also economic. So once conservative Democrats regained control of the legislature in the 1870s and then into the 1880s, they passed a series of landlord and tenant laws, which strip power away and rights away from tenants and give more and more to landlords. Landlords are allowed to be the ones that interpret and enforce the documents, the agreements between landlords and tenants. They pass stock laws, which prohibit tenant farmers from being able to let their animals roam freely. So then tenant farmers in many ways can't keep livestock as well, which makes them more economically dependent upon landlords. And so all these economic changes that are taking place mean that for workers, tenant farmers, sharecroppers in the state, life becomes untenable. There's not a way out of poverty. There's not a way to make ends meet. And so they began to leave. Interestingly enough, a lot of Black ministers, school teachers, legislators are deeply invested in local institutions. And it's against their best interest for the Black working population to leave the state because their institutions will become depopulated. And they strive really hard to convince the population that they shouldn't leave, that they would be better to stay in North Carolina than to seek higher wages in the South, deep South or further out West. And given the size of the movement out of the state, they weren't always very successful at convincing their congregations to stay put.
And that particular story is important in my understanding of, you know, the really the push and pull factors, because I've been co-teaching a course with a colleague here at the University of Delaware on, you know, it's kind of like English and history, it's how to make them better writers and analytical folks. And so one of the things that we've talked about were push and pull factors, right? What makes someone want to stay, but also and pull people to a place, but also what pushes someone out. And so having many of these students who were unaware of you know, repression and the violence that comes during this period. And so when you show it to them, a lot of them have different understandings of what, you know, words like Reconstruction or slavery or Civil War actually mean. And so also one of the other parts when we talk about folks leaving are also folks you had mentioned before about missionaries. And I'd use the example of Charlotte Ford and Pryor. Could you talk about the usage of missionaries in your book, in your text, but also some of the friction that came with some of the missionary work and the individuals that came with the missions?
Right. So there's the missionary movement, which overlaps really well with the Reconstruction period, is massive. And there's investments from Northern churches, white and Black, into that missionary movement. Huge numbers of investments. Ed Bloom's book does a really good job. I'm trying to think of the name of that title of his book, his first book that does this. But it really highlights just sort of the massive contributions that congregations all over the United States make to the South. And often there's a deep sense of gratitude and respect that the local people had for the education, the resources that came. But there were plenty of tensions as well. One is that Northern Black missionaries were coming down, taking political power away from local people. Often these missionaries came in with a particular understanding of middle-class morality that wasn't achievable or desirable by local populations, and so there would be conflict there. At other times, they built institutions to, say, for example, Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a Baptist school, Black Baptist school, but it's run by the American Baptist Home Missionary Society, which is largely a white Northern organization that come down. And as the century goes on, more and more African Americans start to chafe under the fact that their own institutions that they think of as theirs are actually in the control of missionaries from churches somewhere else. Sometimes those are white missionaries, sometimes those are Black missionaries, and they begin for a movement for greater autonomy. This is largely what's behind the movement for the creation of the National Baptist Convention at the end of the 19th century, is how do you get Black Baptist institutions in the hands of Southern Black Baptists, because they largely weren't.
And also think about how, you know, and you had mentioned just then how, you know, it wasn't just white missionary groups as well. It was actually missionary groups who are African American as well. Because I think sometimes people get the mischaracterization that it was exclusively white organizations that led efforts, but it was also African-American ones as well. And every now and again, in some of the source material I've seen, you find some troubling statements about, you know, some of the religious practices that Southern Black folks had in comparison to their Northern, but still Black compatriots too.
Right. And those vary by missionary and they vary by denomination. But right, you'll often see writing which condescends to describe Southern practices as superstition, as overly emotional, as having elements of African religions that they think are unchristian. You'll see a number of that in the writing, a kind of embarrassment by Northern Black missionaries. But, you know, to be honest, most of the Northern Black missionaries' writings who I looked at, you would find these references occasionally, but largely they found themselves too embroiled in defending the political rights of Southern freed people for them to focus on to make those critiques broadly available to white people. So largely those conversations might have been happening within Black churches, but when those Black churches turned outward, they often were much more concerned about defining and defending Black freedoms than they were critiquing Black religious practices, though you see both in the source material. I was just thinking when you were talking earlier of a conflict that happened in New Bern, North Carolina, in a church in the midst of the Civil War. It was a Methodist church with a majority Black membership, and that it had Southern white Methodist leadership of that congregation, and the Southern white Methodist minister fled during the war. And an AME minister comes into town as a missionary, an AME Zion minister comes in as a missionary, a Northern Methodist minister comes in, a Northern unaffiliated or minister comes in, and there are four missionaries, two white and two Black, competing for the allegiance of one Black congregation in New Bern, North Carolina. And one of the very first acts as a free people is having to decide which missionary they want to be their minister, and they have to end up appealing all the way up to the Secretary of War in Washington, D.C., to arbitrate who gets control over this congregation. And ultimately, the Secretary of War says, you know, let the people in the congregation decide and becomes this act of freedom. This is a moment of enfranchisement where Black worshipers in the South, some of their first voting is voting on which missionaries they want to take over the pastorate of their churches. So these are political acts. These are acts as a newly freed people for them to determine who they want in leadership over them.
And that's so interesting because, you know, we're talking about going all the way up to, you know, the Secretary of War during this time, right? Like for some that might seem like a petty church conflict, but no, for those who are, you know, who are in the majority in the church as far as congregants, right? You know, you want to see, you know, y'all talk about democracy, so you know, let's see it, right? Let's get involved, right? It's not like we haven't wanted to get involved all this time. Y'all have barred us literally from doing so, and so it's so cool to hear about how some of the first bits of voting that African Americans had in this region that you talked about in New Bern, I believe, you know, it wasn't at the ballot box, or at least in the conventional sense. It was within their church walls as well. And so that's a truly tremendous, tremendous story. And so as well, and in the short time that we still have with you, can you speak to kind of the nature, because I think it was so cool that you had mentioned Shaw before. And so, you know, their most famous alum is Ella Baker. And so, you know, she's a very important figure, obviously, of the 20th century. But can you highlight, you know, the history and some of the organizing of some of the Black women characters in your book as well, as far as their religious grounding here? Because obviously, you know, they're as far as a clergy, it's going to be a little different. But talk about the stories of some of the African-American women encased in your narrative.
Yeah. So the AME Zion is the first Black denomination to begin ordaining women to the clergy. And they do that in 1898 is the first time that they ordain a woman to the position of pastor or elder, as it's mentioned in the Methodist traditions, though there are deacons and preachers much earlier than that. But Black women have historically and today make up the majority of Black churches, right? So they predominate in the pews. They are often writing, they occasionally write letters to the editors in these Black religious newspapers to join the arguments. Black women occasionally come together and organize joint statements like they did during the crisis in Wilmington in 1898, where they urged men to risk bodily harm in order to make it to the polls and vote. And they used biblical arguments to shame the men into voting despite the threats of violence. There are often missionaries employed by these churches. One of the ones that features prominently in my fifth chapter is a missionary, R.A. Williams, and she is a part of the women's auxiliary movements. So they're often these denominational groups will have women's auxiliary conventions that meet sometimes in conjunction with the church conventions of male clergy. They organize relief efforts, moral reform campaigns like temperance and prohibition. They produce literature for Sunday school, but they also are having discussions about politics and all of those things. And we see them addressing conventions, making those arguments publicly. A lot of the really prominent women writers from sort of Black politics area and Black churches in North Carolina have been written about well by others. So Glenda Gilmore's Gender and Jim Crow covers an overlapping time period as my book and covers North Carolina and uses some of the same sources that I do and really highlights how active Black women were. And sometimes Black women even had the ability to say publicly what Black men did not have to, because they were not perceived as the same threat that Black men were. So you see a real active Black women being really active in the public sphere as they're making these arguments, particularly I see in the temperance movement, which is the subject of my fourth chapter, as an area for them to see, feel empowered to enact moral reform in their own communities. And they're able to do that in ways that that affect change both in Black churches and in state politics.
And thank you for that, because, you know, on the New Books in African American Studies podcast channel, we love to cite Black women and uplift the names and the stories of Black women, you know, throughout the diaspora. And so I definitely appreciate you on that part. And so in closing, in the last couple of minutes, with this particular book being done, The End of Days, could you speak to us about some of your new book, some of your new work, right? Some of the stuff that you're working on, because this book was published in 2016. So, you know, it's been a couple of years. And so we would like to know, because sometimes, you know, we get a little greedy on the New Books in African American Studies channel, because we always like to know when to expect our authors, writers, and historians, right, to be able to come back and have a little chat for about an hour or so.
Well, when I was writing The End of Days, I kept in the back of my mind that my next project I wanted to start with the Baptist War in Jamaica in 1831-32. I think initially attracted just because of the name Baptist War.
I definitely could see that. I'm intrigued my doggone self.
Right. It's a massive slave uprising in Jamaica that is organized out of the local Baptist church there. And the Baptists in Jamaica, controversially at the time, would elevate enslaved Black men to leadership within local congregations as preachers, as deacons. And these leaders created networks that disseminated news within the British Empire about slavery and the abolitionist campaigns that were happening in London. They organized and disseminated news from a state to a state. And they began preaching a gospel that was anti-slavery, that considered slavery to be illegitimate, and ultimately organized a strike across sugar plantations in the north and northwest parts of the island. And the strike led to become the second largest uprising in the Western Hemisphere, by some counts, second only to the Haitian Revolution. And it ultimately is unsuccessful. That is that even though it was a relatively nonviolent strike, it was met with massive violence from the colonial militia on the island. And Black churches were destroyed. Missionaries, particularly white Baptist missionaries from London, were exiled from the island and sent back to England. And when they get there, they're able to give testimony of the brutality of the colonial militia to peaceful Baptist striking for dignity and freedom. And it helps sway public opinion in the debates over emancipation in 1832, 1833. And the British Empire does vote for emancipation in 1833. Parliament does. And so studying that got me really interested in understanding networks of radical Black religion throughout the Atlantic. So astute listeners will recognize that another radical Black Baptist struck out against slavery in the very same year in Southampton, Virginia. And mm-hmm. So this idea that – so we've got the earliest of Black overseas missionaries. Actually, the first overseas missionary from the United States period was a free Black man from New York, Moses Baker, who went to northern Jamaica shortly after – the American Revolution. And then a group of Black Baptists in Jamaica ultimately leave after emancipation and take form a mission in Cameroon. And there they encounter British colonialism in Cameroon and then later German colonialism. And so I began to want to know, right, what's going on here? How are Black missionaries in the U.S., in the Caribbean, in West Africa, how are they encountering slavery and colonialism, and where do they find themselves cooperating with those powers, and where do they preach gospels that are resisting and fighting back against those groups. And so I'm not really sure that's going to go. I'm definitely in the stage where I'm immersing myself in source material, and I want the material to speak to me. But that's what I'm asking now.
Well, hey, you know, we see based upon the last 59 minutes and 33 seconds and counting how immersing yourself, you know, where you can go when you immerse yourself in the source material, because, you know, it led you to a tremendous book, The End of Days, African American Religion and Politics in the Age of Emancipation. So if that's what happens, you know, when Dr. Matthew Harper goes ahead and immerses himself in the material, then I think we'll be on here fairly soon to be able to talk about this great new work on Black Atlantic, religious radicalism. And so I already know that that's going to be a bomb ass book.
Well, thank you. And thanks for having me. This was a great opportunity. I've enjoyed your podcast and I enjoyed the interview as well. Thanks.
Very good. Very good. And so once again, folks, we have had the beautiful and amazing opportunity to have on here Dr. Matthew Harper, Assistant Professor of History and Africana Studies at Mercer University in Georgia, in Macon, if I'm not mistaken. And so once again, we've had him on the program, New Books in African American Studies, to discuss his UNC Press 2016 published book, End of Days, African American Religion and Politics in the Age of Emancipation. And so once again, we've had the great opportunity of having Dr. Harper on. And until next time, folks, I am your host, Adam McNeil, New Books in African American Studies channel. Over and out.